Right. What I was asked to speak about today was handling power appropriately, which I was a little bit put off by the title of that topic. Like, if you're going to be a rabbi and you're thinking of it as, you know, your key to power, then you're probably going into the wrong profession. And probably whatever profession you go into, you should probably like take a step back and just get some help. But But the more I thought about it, the more I thought that there is something to the idea of handling whatever power comes with being a rabbi appropriately. And I want to break it up essentially into four sections. Section number one is just general humility that is necessary for all Jews, but in particular for a rabbi. Section number two is the power to destroy. Section number three is the power to build, and section number four is the one and only true power. So that's when I think about power, I think about these four things. I had a student of mine from DRS, who I'm very close with, a really wonderful guy. You know, one of the great things when you're in chinuch for a long enough time is that you get to see talmidim who far outperform you in every which way, in midos, in Torah learning, in everything. So one of these guys who was going into Rabbanus, and he asked for, like, before he started his first job, he asked me, what do I need to learn? Should I learn Hilchos Kriyas HaTorah? Because those are the shailas that come up in the moment. They're not going to have a chance to look up later. Do I learn Hilchos Basa B'chalav? Like, well, what do I need to learn? I said, there's only one thing that you need to learn, and that is how to be humble. If you have that, then everything else is going to fall into place. Meaning, if you're able to say, when you don't know, I don't know, or I have to look into it, as opposed to trying to save face by making up an answer on the spot, or, oh, maybe a cheshbon like this, without having any evidence for any of your answers, then that will get you into trouble. Yeah.
But we might say, if you're in a situation where they need an answer right there.
So take the time, open up Mishnah Berurah, and find the answer, even if that's what it takes. Meaning that will be a limud also. That you say, you know, I always tell my talmidim, my children, who's the biggest Talmud Chacham you've ever met in your entire life? And the answer, they know who they're talking. They always say Rav Shechter. Rav Shechter is the biggest Talmud Chacham you've ever met in our entire life. Who says I don't know more frequently than any other person you've ever met in your entire life? And the answer, Rav Shechter. He says, I don't know, more frequently than anybody. Now, it's true, his I don't know often doesn't mean I don't know. It means a lot of other things that are like, I think Rav Daniel Feldman has like six different explanations of Rav Shechter's I don't know. So there's a whole hierarchy of meaning and value to the different types of I don't know, depending on tone, inflection, context. But nevertheless, to say I don't know, or to say I have to look into it, or to say, does anybody else know, you know, to have a discussion about it, even though there are certain things that come up on the spot, I think just critically, it's critical that a person be humble. It happens to be this guy who I told this piece of advice to, is now a couple of years in, and he said, he came over to me recently, just this past summer, and he said, Best advice was just to be told to be humble, because it's a catch-all, meaning it really covers everything. It's not like you're never going to learn everything. You're never going to be able to answer every single question. You just have to know what you know and what you don't know, and you have to be able to handle that. No one's going to think you're an Am Haaretz if you say, I don't know. Whenever I think of I don't know, I think Rav Meir Tversky likes to tell the story. I heard him tell the story of Rav Hirschsprung. Rav Hirschsprung, Zichrono Livracha, was a Gaon Olam, was a photographic memory. He wrote Haskamas, Rav Shechter's early Svarim, there at Tzatzvi, and I think maybe Big Fatzon also. So he, Rav Hirschsprung, was sitting at a chasana once, and someone came over to him and asked him a question, and Rav Hirschsprung said, I don't know. And the guy, like, you know, was a bacher, and he was, like, pretty proud of himself. He asked a question that Rav Hirschsprung doesn't know. So he was, like, you know, walking away with his head held up high, and Rav Hirschsprung turns to the Rav sitting next to him. He says, it's so cute. He thinks his I don't know and my I don't know are the same. Meaning, like, I don't know could mean that's a, it's a difficult tosos, because it's against the Taisus Nevod Zara, and especially if you understand the Rashba's biur of the Gemara and Gittin, it's difficult. Or I don't know, it could mean which way do you hold this page? Like how do you read it? You know, I don't know how to read Hebrew. There are different types of I don't know. So there's a certain level of I don't know. But a person should always be comfortable saying be comfortable with recognizing what you do know and what you don't know. An unhealthy sense of self, a sense of gaiva, leads people to do a lot of bad things, leads people to believe that they're entitled to things that they are not entitled to, or that they can get away with things that people should not be able to get away with. Many, many rabbinic scandals have happened as a result of gaiva. Mariv Rabbi Rav Shechter has a tremendous sense of how to sniff out Bali Gaiva. I mean, there are people that I've spoken with him about, you know, that I've quoted maybe, and he'll just like subtly hint, you know, maybe not to be so mushba from such a person, and then it will become, you know, I'll find out later that the person fell into this scandal, that scandal, because he senses that it's not that he knows what the person's up to, but he has a tremendous sense of when a person is a Bali Gaiva, when a person has an unhealthy sense of himself. And b'makom gadluso shamata motzei vasnuso, the idea of being an anav becomes more critical as you advance in your career, and people start throwing kavod at you, and you start to listen to it. You know, all of a sudden you start out, you're just a guy, you're just a name. Then you get smicha, and you get a job maybe as a rabbi, and people start calling you rabbi so and so. Ooh, I'm a chashva rabbi. And then you get a little bit older, just by virtue of age alone, or maybe you start teaching in a college or something, and now you're not rabbi, now you're rav, right? Now you're not just a rabbi. Ooh, I'm rav. Oh, and then they say, our Rosh Yeshiva. Ooh, when they call me up at a chuppah, does it take like, it has to take like a solid 30 seconds to say just like how great I am. So there's a natural sense as you advance to start to feel like you're an Adam Chashuv, and that's where Anivus becomes all the more important. You know, and it's important to just keep things in context. You know, every time someone says, oh, you built a community, often it just means that you stayed there long enough to have it built around you. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you've actually, a monkey could have been in your spot also, and maybe the community would have been built because it's in the tri-state area and people needed a place to live and it was a little cheaper. You know, you have to keep these things in perspective sometimes. Rav Willig wrote in his Haskama to the Sefer HaKona Alamo, the Shem Rav Chaim Velazhiner, Hovas HaMalachos Noos HaRabanos. Rav Chaim Velazhiner writes, Rav Chaim Velazhiner explains, Hovas HaMalacha means that you should love the malacha of being a rabbi. Meaning, what's the malacha of being a rabbi? Learning, paskening shailas, doing chesed, helping people out, usnoos rabbanus. But don't love, you should hate the rabbanus that comes along with being a rabbi. The sense of kavod that people give you, the honor that people try to give you, you should hate that. And part of being humble is to avoid even what they, contemporary culture, what they call a humble brag. A lot of times people will say, I think the classic examples, right? What do they say about what's a humble brag? It's so annoying that I have to maintain both mansions in the Hamptons and in the, you know, like as if you're complaining about something, but you're really just bragging about what you have. Oh, it's these new features on the new Mercedes are so difficult to figure out, you know. So that's a humble. So there are rabbinic versions of humble brag also. I'm just so busy because of all these shilas that I get from all over the world, you know, because like the world can't continue without me, because there are rabbinic versions of humble brags also. It's important to avoid that. I remember when I was younger, you hear it less now, thank God. It used to drive me crazy when I was younger. You'd hear it if you were a rabbi 50 and above, then the way you'd refer to one of our Gedolei Adar, to Rav Shechter, would be, ah, Reb Herschel, my old friend Herschel. You know, it was like, are you joking? Like, you're not dirt under his toenails. You know, Reb Herschel, you know, who do you think you are? You know, so it's important to, but a person falls into this, well, I'm a rabbi, I've been a rabbi for 10 years, 20 years, you know, and as I build up those years, then I build up that sense of what I am. It's important to realize you're also not so busy. Rabbis often like to complain how busy they are. There are a lot of people that are very busy. A lot of people have jobs that are very demanding, even more demanding than the rabbanus. And there are articles about burnout, about rabbis burning out. You know what? Lawyers burn out and doctors burn out. There's a lot of jobs where people can burn out. Don't feel like, oh, because I'm a rabbi, you know, and really, really, really. I mean, just when we take an honest look inside of ourselves, how many of us don't waste time? You know, Rav Moshe Feinstein, every second was accounted for. If we have like 10 free minutes, we're like, nah, I got to go somewhere in 10 minutes anyway, and we end up not doing anything. I can't even listen to a 10-minute halacha shiur in 10 minutes anymore. You know, so like, what am I going to do? Like, we're throwing away time here and there. So when someone calls you and says, oh, Rabbi, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. I know Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, who's one of the gedolim in Rabbanus in terms of what it means to be a rav of a community and to maintain a proper sense of self. He's the one that actually taught this topic last year in this class. So you really got shortchanged, because he's like the person you'd want to hear from this. He insists that rabbis correct people when they thank them for their time. No, my time is no more valuable than your time. Your time is also valuable. And who knows, maybe that will inspire a person to start thinking about their own time as being valuable as well. But it's also a healthy reminder for the rabbi that his time is not more precious than other people's times. And if you do have a couple of minutes here and there, so think about what can you accomplish in a minute or two? How can you be kona lama b'shah achas? And sometimes you can. You could send a text to someone who you know as an ill relative. You can make an Erev Shabbos phone call to an almana. It takes 2 minutes. The almana doesn't want to sit on the phone schmoozing with you for an hour. She just wants to hear that you care about her and that you want to ask her how her grandchildren are or whatever. And that's what you could do in those little spurts of time.
Yeah. Who's that story about? Who said your time is no more valuable than mine?
Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg always likes to tell people that's what you should say. Yeah.
Okay. When you said Rav Schechter, you said don't quote these people so much. You know, was it because they're Balei Gaver, because they're Balei Gaver, they must be doing other things.
I think Gaiva is it's a gateway midah. All the Sifrei Musar talk about this, that Gaiva is the Aviv Osatuma of all bad midos, because it always leads to other things. So I never actually spoke to Rav Schechter about what is it that he so despises about Balei Gaiva, but I would imagine that he has that sense that Balei Gaiva, very often it's not just Gaiva. I spoke to Rav Willig about this more explicitly once, actually in a radio interview I did with Rabbi Willig. There's this guy, David Lichtenstein, I don't know if any of you...
Headlines,
right. So somehow I ended up hosting a couple of shows when he was too busy or something. So I interviewed Rabbi Willig about rabbis who had been through scandals, about rabbis who had fallen. It was a topic that interested me for a variety of reasons. And I asked Rabbi Willig, like, what kind of rabbis are unfit to serve? What if a rabbi is just a Balgaiva? Is he unfit to serve? And he says, Aryeh, you and I both know many successful rabbis who are terrible Balgaiva. Like, he thought that alone is not always indicative of worse things. But it's something that certainly doesn't smell right when a rabbi is, or when anybody's a Balgaiva, but especially when a rabbi is a Balgaiva. My wife was making fun of me recently. We were at a simcha, and there was a guy who spoke, and the guy was like, some people just like rub you the wrong way, like they everything about his manner and his, was like self-important and was. It's the exact opposite. You ever hear of Moshe Weinberger speak? Like the most self-effacing, it was the exact opposite of that. It was just like this self-important, coming off greater than thou, this whole attitude. And he came over to me afterwards when my wife was standing right next to me, and he said, you should know, when I speak, I try to mimic the way you speak. My wife is like, yeah, good job. So, that was a healthy, a healthy musser to hear that, but gaiva is the gateway midah. The sefer Orchus Sadikim goes through midah by midah, and he starts with gaiva and anivus because it is the avyevo satoma of all midos ra'os, and it's something that you need to work on your entire life to just have checks and balances, make sure you don't get out of control. As you succeed in different things, the Ribbono Shelom allows you to succeed and puts things in your path where you're able to accomplish things that you shouldn't take credit for it as if it's yours. The people in your shul, if you're a shul rabbi, are not your balabatim. They're certainly not your constituents. How does Rav Moshe Weinberger talk about the people in his shul? my dear friends. That's what they are. They're your dear friends, they're people you love, they're people you care about. They're not people you complain about because they are beneath you and they just use up your time and bother you with what in your mind is something trivial. No, these are your dear friends, and these are your family, and these are people who you're there for, and that's your job, is to be there for them.
So I work in a shul and I get calls from parents that, like, I literally, like, they'll call you and I don't use direct, like a half an hour, like a weekly call from a certain parent who wants a half an hour rundown of everything going on in the youth department and the pros and cons of each program. So my youth committee told me, like, that call is there to waste your time. Don't deal with it, right?
So, okay, yeah, how to deal with the nudnik? Meaning that there is such a thing called the nudnik, you know, but how to deal with it requires a great deal of skill and wisdom,
yeah.
Because sometimes if you indulge a nudnik a little too much, it will only feed itself. You have to be, Rav Naftali Yeager, the Rashiva Shayasha, said, what's the definition of a nudnik? Someone who, when you ask him how you're doing, he gives you an honest answer. Right? Well, she goes, Baruch Hashem, fine. Well, my back hurts. Gives you a whole story. But Enochinami, I'm talking begadol, and there are people that have, and sometimes there's something more to that, and you have to figure out why. Why are they so concerned about their children, about what's going on in the youth department? What kind of trauma have they experienced, or is it just them that they have a personality disorder or something of that nature? So you have to be careful with that.
Is it not when we're talking about, like, the constituents as friends, not constituents as friends? Is it not important to have, like, a separation between the rav and...
It is important, and that will happen naturally in almost every circumstance. Now, there are cases. I have a rav who I'm close with who went to DRS when I was a rebbe there, who told me that, like, he's younger than everybody in the shul, except for the guys that he used to play ball with in high school. Those are the only guys that are his age. Everyone else is older than him. And the guys he used to play ball with in high school, you know, the older people, they could adjust to the fact that it's a younger Rav. But the guys he used to play ball, they're like, hey, what's up, number 32, how you doing, you know? So that's a challenge. That's a challenge. But for the most part, it's like there's a certain distance that's created automatically. So much so that I would strongly encourage everybody, and I certainly in my life, it's important to have people who call you by your first name. The people in your shul should not be calling you by your first name, obviously, but it's important to have people who call you by your first name. So don't lose touch with your friends. You know, it's important to have a great... I still get together several times a year, which is, I admit, for a 40-year-old, it's highly unusual, but several times a year, often with our entire families, with my close friends from high school, a group of five or six of us. We just had Thanksgiving dinner together in Teaneck last... I'm the only rabbi in the group. They're all good from people who accomplish a lot more in life than I do, and we enjoy each other's company, and they call me by my first name, and it's good. It's good that we're able to do that and to just hang out, and no one's reverential or anything like that. And that's important. It's important to have those relationships in your life. It's not always possible. My wife was saying how, you know, she was insistent from day one when we came to the shul 13 years ago. No one calls her Rebbetzin. You call me Alana, you call me by my name. She was not interested in being called Rebbetzin. That was her shtick. That was her thing. She didn't want to be. She really didn't want that distance. And a lot of the people that daven in our shul are people who I went to yeshiva with, who are, you know, people that we relate to very much. Some who are a little firmer than us, some a little less firm than us, some pretty much the same as us. But, you know, we all respect each other and love each other. And she was saying that she went to, like, the Rebbetzin's conference, and it was so difficult for her to hear that so many of the Rebbetzin's, they don't have any friends. Like, their only friends are at the Rebbetzin's conference when they get together and they have someone who can relate to them. And that's very hard. That's a very hard thing to go through. A person should have friends. And with today's ability to stay connected, no matter where you are, in easier ways, you know, with whatever social media outlets you deem kosher and worthwhile, you know, it's important to maintain friends who just think of you as a friend.
But not to, like, hang out with people that go to your shul. Like, let's say you're like an out of town community. There's, like, nobody there. It's like, Louisville, Kentucky, or
so you really have to know. You have to know what you have to know to read the situation. There's no, like, set rules. Like, you know, should a rabbi go to the Super Bowl party when his when people in the shul invite him to the Super Bowl party? I don't know. You know, should we kicking back beers with I don't know, should you be sitting watching a football game for 4 hours, and that's what they think that the rabbi has time to do? I don't know. Maybe in certain communities yes, in other communities no. You have to know how to handle yourself. I mean, for me personally, when Chevra would get together, they'd have a Super Bowl party. So they said they would come over, like, and say, I don't know if you want to come, just want you to know that you're welcome to come, but it's okay if you don't come. You know, they didn't want to
see
say,
you on your show?
Yeah. What? No, well, people in my shul.
It's amazing how many people come to this class and talk about this exact same case.
Of the Super Bowl party?
That's common, very common. Every year, the same time.
So it happens to be there's a Chevra that has a Chabura that they have a rotating Chabura, and it's Sunday night Chabura, so canceled for the Super Bowl, so they do it at halftime of the Super Bowl. So once a year, they'd ask me to give the Chabura at the Super Bowl, so then I could come a little early, I could stay a little late, whatever you want, and that way, but I was on for the Chabura at halftime. So that was a nice way for them to do it, but you really just have to it's very hard to talk specifics over here. I would go, you know, like the David Tyree game. I don't know if you remember when the helmet catch. So I was there for that. I think I went back to maybe pick up one of my kids or something and stuck around for that drive, you know, back when Eli Manning was a respected figure in New York. So another like a pet peeve that I guess I have, and that I think is also important. My friend David Bashefkin once wrote an article about rabbinic bios. You know, they ask you for a bio if you're going to speak somewhere, and like you could really tell a lot about a person from his bio, not because the bio describes what he is, but because you always know that he wrote that bio because no one else is writing your bio. So like, what exactly does this person think of himself? Because that's, you know, he's the one that's describing all of his accomplishments. In general, when asked to write a bio of, if let's say, I'll give an example. Last year, my wife and I were asked to be the recipients of some award at a dinner for an organization breakfast for an organization that's a wonderful organization, does really fantastic work. We've had no shaychus with it, meaning other than referring people who needed their help to that organization, we had no direct shaychus. I've never done anything for them, that's for sure. And my wife never had any real involvement with it either. They just needed a rabbinic name to put on the thing. You know, so we like the organization, we think it does great work. So we agreed to do it. And they asked for a bio, so I wrote, Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz is the rabbi of the Beis HaKnesset of North Woodmere and is a rebbe in Lander College for Men. Ilana Leibowitz is the driving force behind it, and then I wrote like a three paragraphs about my wife, and she was ready to kill me. She didn't know that I did it, but it was so worth it. It was, but that should be how, you know. Not just in you know, as a way of showing a sense of humility or whatever that you deflect, but that should be how you really feel. You're going to get more honor than you deserve. Your wife is probably not going to get more honor than she deserves. Deflect as much honor as you can in her direction. She deserves it a lot more than you, and you're getting way more than you deserve anyway, usually. Introductions also. Introductions are sometimes so over the top, and if you sit there listening to them, you could start believing them. And you know, the best introductions for your anivus are just the descriptive ones. You know, like just this is his job. You know, he is the rabbi of this shul. Okay, that's a fact. I could take that. Once people start getting too flowery or whatever, I would recommend if you're being introduced somewhere, think about all the things that they're not saying. You know, if they're describing, he has this many shiurim and Wayu Torah, you know, so like you think, oh, so if you take Amaratzus and you multiply it by 6,000, so he's 6,000 times an Amaratz, you know, like, but don't think about that as like an accomplishment. You think about, why aren't they talking about my chesed? Because I don't do enough. Why aren't they talking about, you know, anything else in my life, my midos? Because they're not what they should be. Meaning, if that was my outstanding characteristic, that's what they would be describing. So they have to. So think about what they're not saying. Also, maybe that helps a little. I can tell you, Rav Schechter's trick, at least as far as I've observed over the last 20 years, you know, he obviously hears a lot of very nice introductions. All of them are deserved, and he deserves a lot more. He never acknowledges it. He acknowledges for like a second. thank you very much. The Rambam writes, it's just thank you very much. Always. It's a lot of times people try to get cutesy. Oh, I don't know if I deserve that. And then you're just drawing more attention to the introduction. No, just get past it. Get past the introduction. And sometimes you're so taken by how great you are from the introduction that you forget to acknowledge the rabbi of the shul where you're speaking, the audience that's come out to hear you and taken from their time to hear. So that should be the immediate shift of focus. These are just some general tips in maintaining a basic sense of anivus. But we haven't really been discussing power. Let's talk about power. I mentioned to a friend of mine. Was there a question someone had? No? I mentioned to a friend of mine recently that I was asked to speak about handling rabbinic power appropriately. So I said, "What kind of?" I wasn't. It was my cousin actually, who's not a rabbi. But who knows a lot of rabbis and is very involved in Jewish organizations. So I said, what do you think I should talk about, rabbinic power? My cousin's name is, give credit where credit is due, his name is Zev Berman. He's actually first cousins with President Ari Berman. We share, the president and I share an uncle. Julius Berman is my uncle and his uncle, so we share an uncle. So Julius Berman's son, Zev Berman, I said, I'm speaking about rabbinic power, what do you think? So he says, you have the power to destroy lives. That was his response. You have the power to destroy lives. So what does he mean by that? Remember that you're the rabbi for everybody. You know, in order to make a community run, money is necessary. You need money for buildings, you need money for programming. It's very easy for rabbis to fall into the trap of, you know, when your cell phone starts buzzing and you see the name of Big Gvir, right, that you immediately, oh, I got to answer it right away. You see the name of a little guy, you know, sits in the back or whatever, I'll deal with it later. You're the rabbi for everybody, and everybody needs to feel like they're treated the same, needs to be treated the same. Of course, you will have to develop relationships where you'll often have to fundraise and whatever, but that doesn't make that person any more chashuv. And, you know, sometimes you'll see, like, a person's station in life will change in one direction or the other in terms of how they're doing financially. It should, if you realize that that's changing your attitude toward that person, that you're defining that person by their financial success, well, then you're in real trouble. That they define themselves very often by their own financial success is hard enough, and that they need help with that sometimes. I was just talking to a guy recently. He's a brilliant guy. Sweetheart of a guy, mamish like a tzaddik, and he was a partner in a major international law firm. The law firm went belly up. I don't know what happened. The law firm just totally went bust, and he lost his job. He's now the guy that you call when you get a traffic ticket. You know, it's a very different kind of practice, and it's a major hit to a person's ego. He's able to handle that because he never defined himself as a partner in a prestigious law firm. He defined himself by his chesed. He defined himself by his family. But make sure you, as the rabbi, also define him that way, and that you treat everyone in that way. A misbehaving rabbi can shatter a person. I've seen this happen, where a rabbi gets caught doing things, inappropriate things with women, inappropriate things with, God forbid, with children, with, you know, all sorts of, with money, with whatever the inappropriate behavior is. And the people who relied on that person for inspiration and for their connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because, you know, that's what the Gemara says, that you're supposed to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How are you supposed to? Eish Uchlahu, he's an all-consuming fire. So the Gemara has two etzos. One is histabik b'midosav, that you're supposed to connect to the midos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but the other is to be mistabik with Talmidei Chachamim, because the Talmidei Chachamim are supposed to bring you closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So if that was your vehicle to get close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and now you see that the person's a lowlife, that could destroy a person. It destroys a person, especially if the person dealt with Balei Tshuva or with Geirim. It could absolutely destroy a person. So that's a tremendous responsibility. Everyone, every Jew has a responsibility to do mitzvos, not to do averos. The responsibility is magnified many, many times over when you're a rabbi, when you're someone who's guiding people spiritually. A rabbi has the power to destroy his own family. I once had the opportunity of attending a seminar at the now defunct Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik Heritage Foundation in Boston, that was run by Rabbi J.J. Schachter. And it was a bunch of rabbis, mostly young rabbis, and Rabbi Schachter was giving us Chomer Ledrush and Eitzah, and he gave us a Musar Shmuz that I will never forget. He gave us a Musar Shmuz about family. And it was so impactful because I happened to know his family. I happened to be very close with his son-in-law, and my wife is very close with his daughter. And I spent a lot of Shabbos meals at his table. And I saw that he lived this. Lives it, not just lived it, lives this. There's a tremendous yetzer hara for a rabbi to start thinking that his career, his job is so important because it's ruchnius, it's neshamos, I'm dealing with life and death situations, that his family, you know, sort of takes a back seat. The importance of prioritizing family cannot be overstated. The way Rabbi Schachter said it is, you know, you look at the Rambam, and the Rambam describes the thousands, alafim urvavos, of people that Avraham Avinu was makariv. Thousands and tens of thousands of people that he was makariv. Wow, what an enormous success. What critical work to teach monotheism to all these people. Where are all those people? What happened to all those people? Were they Avram Avinu's legacy? No, what was Avram Avinu's legacy? Ki bi Yitzchak yikari lecha zera. It was that one, it was Yitzchak. That was his legacy.
The Kedushas says an opposite part.
What?
And then the Kedushas lady says an opposite part. Why is that? Elah told us Noach. Noach, Shem, Ham, and Shem, and his sons. It doesn't say that by Avram, because Avram was everybody.
Ah, okay. Yeah, yeah, but that's this resonates with me a little bit more. Such a critical idea. I was talking to Rabbi Aaron Palm, who is the you may be able to tell from his last name, the son of Rav Palm, Zichron Levracha, and Rabbi Palm was telling me that this Rabbi Aaron Palm has, I think, 9 children or 10 children, something like that, maybe more, I don't remember. One of them is I believe, autistic or some other type of special needs child, and he was very broken when he and his wife realized and had to deal with it. Are they equipped to deal with it? And he said that he had a Rebbe in Eretz Yisrael. Was it Michal Zilber, maybe? I don't remember who exactly it was. Someone in Eretz Yisrael was a big, big, big Talmud Chacham, who also has a special needs child, and he said that he went to talk to his Rebbe, and his Rebbe said that at this time, this was many, many years ago, he said the Rebbe told him that at that point his child was a teenager already, and he still couldn't go to the bathroom himself, couldn't change himself, he needed to be cleaned up, and it was becoming too much for his wife to handle, for the Rebbetzin to handle. It's pasnish, the teenage boy that she's going to be dealing with, cleaning him up, and so that was his job. It was the Rosh Yeshiva's job to do that, to clean up. So sometimes he'd be in yeshiva in Seder, and he'd get a phone call from his wife, you have to come home, he soiled himself, and it's a mess, and you have to come home. And he would come home to clean up his son, and he told Rabbi Palm, he said, you should know, when I clean up my son, I feel like the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. Palm looks at him like, that's like a little much to say that. What do you mean you feel like Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippurim? He says, what do you know about the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippurim? He's the only person that's qualified to do the Avodah. Because he's the Kohen Gadol. So he's the only one that can do the Avodah Lefnai V'Lefnim. He says, I give a shir in yeshiva. There might be 10 other people that could give that same shir in yeshiva and 10 others who can give it better than me. I don't know. Does the Ribbono Shel Olam want me selling shoes and not giving shir in yeshiva? I don't know. I don't know that I'm doing what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants. But here's what I do know. The Ribbono Shel Olam gave me this child. And I'm the only one who can do this avoda. And if I'm the only one who can do this avoda, I'm the Kohen Gadol in Yom Kippurim. And every parent should look at their children that way. That I'm the only one. I was the one entrusted by the Ribbono Shel Olam with these neshamos, with these children. And it's important to put away your phone during homework and dinner time. Ah, Shaila might come up. There are other rabbis that also have phones and that maybe aren't busy right now that will be able to deal with the Shailas. And if it's life or death, they'll find you. Somehow they'll call the house phone over and over and over again until you have no choice but to answer. They'll find you. There will be other ways to get in touch with you. put it away when you're learning with your kids, when you're during homework time, dinner time. You know, one of the great advantages of being in Rabbanus, I know for me personally at least, is that I was always able to be home between 6:30 and 8 for the most part at night. Afterwards, I'd have to go out, I'd be up early in the morning, but for the most part, you know, if had I done my other option of a career when I was your age, where I was still considering whether I wanted to go to law school or not, I've seen what happened to all my friends who went to law school. They had to work, you know, 15, 16-hour days for years and years and years in the hopes of making partner, and then often still have to work crazy hours, and the kids saw them on Shabbos. So, you know, as much as we complain how busy we are, we're not the busiest people alive, and we do have the opportunity, and we should take advantage of the opportunity to be able to spend time with our children. It was so heartbreaking. One of my friends told me, a friend of mine in Shul, who's a Talmud Chacham, he's a partner in a law firm, but he's been through Shas a couple of times, and his mom is an unbelievable person, a tremendous Baal Tzedakah, Baal Chesed, and he said to me that it must have been a legal holiday or something when his kids were little, and he was off from work, and his children saw him, and they said, "Is it Shabbos?" Like, they really were confused for a second. They were thrown off, because if daddy was home, it must be Shabbos. Like, they couldn't... Should we answer that?
No.
Okay, I don't know. It's also important to realize, Chacham Hizaru B'Devreichem, the power to destroy can often happen with words. You know, a word or two that you say something, a small comment that could be taken seriously and can hurt a person that you didn't even, you just weren't thinking. So you weren't thinking, you said something to somebody. I had a situation, unfortunately more than once, where I just wasn't thinking and I said something. You know, there's... Where you thought it was so benign, but you know, I called someone up to ask to really they did something that I thought was improper to somebody else, and I wanted them to ask mechila from the other person, so I called them up and told them to ask mechila, and they said, you know, they were very, very hurt by the fact that I called them. They said, you know, you're going to see me in shul in 2 days, so that this was so terrible that it warranted that you go out of your way to call me. Like, you have to realize, a call from the rabbi is scary. It's like a call to the principal's office. You don't know why you're being called. So if you leave a message for someone, "Hi, it's Rabbi so-and-so, I would like to speak to you." What do you think the person is thinking at that point in time? Oh, what did I do? I could use a favor, if you could please call me back. Or, "I need to pick your brain about something. I need some aids." You know, say something that puts their mind at ease, that they know that they're there to help you, and not, you know, not that you're not after them. Or at least, you know, do something to mitigate that you know, the power of the words of a rabbi, because you're in that position. When you're criticized, it's very easy to ignore criticism and say, everyone else tells me they love me. So, okay, that person is just, you know, an outlier. They don't really, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. Think when you're criticized. Maybe there's something to it. And maybe there's nothing to the actual criticism, but maybe that's a relationship that you haven't developed the way you should have. And that's why the person reacts to you that way. Maybe had you been there with that person when their parent was dying and they needed someone to hold their hand, they wouldn't have the chutzpah to be able to talk to you that way or to be able to talk about you that way. Maybe. Not always. Sometimes there are just people that are terrible people. But for the most part, people are reacting to something. You know, I was just at the Kinnis Shluchim that Chabad has every year. There's a good friend in our shul who buys a table every year. I don't know why. I don't know what his connection to Chabad really is. I think he supports some Chabad in Massachusetts. I'm not sure why, but he buys a table every year. So he asks me each year if I want to come. The last 2 years, I said yes. Very fascinating, very inspiring, very interesting. The whole thing was very interesting. But one of the quotes from the Lubavitcher Rebbe that really struck me was that the Rebbe, they have a lot of recordings of the Rebbe, which was, Chabad was so far ahead of their time in terms of recording everything. In the 60s and the 70s, they were already recording every single interaction on video, everything he said on tape. And that's why he's able to still be the Rebbe, even though he's been dead for 20 years, you know, because he's still actually, they have a recording of him saying everything for every situation, you know. So he one of the things he said was that if you go to a place where there are 10,000 Jews and you've affected 9,999 of them, you're going to receive enormous schar, but your shlichus is not accomplished. It's just a tremendous standard to live up to. That if there's someone that you haven't reached, so maybe take that personally, that, okay, I could be doing more. I could be reaching out more to that person. The power to destroy, you know, when faced with criticism, it's very easy to just fire back a snarky email, you know, in return, or to just ignore them because they're nundik or they're, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. It's much more challenging and much more appropriate to do what Rav Moshe Feinstein did. You know, the tshuva where someone said to him, someone wrote to Rav Moshe, that it's inappropriate that Rav Moshe takes a ride to MTJ on Erev Shabbos within the 18 minutes. How do you do this? People are Mekabel Shabbos already, and you're taking a ride in a car to MTJ on Erev Shabbos. And how does Rav Moshe write back? He does not say, wow, you are such an idiot. I mean, like, I am Rav Moshe Feinstein, and you are so not Rav Moshe Feinstein. He does not say that. Thank you so much for the Mussar. Sometimes people are hesitant to give me Mussar because I happen to be a Rosh Yeshiva, and it's so such a breath of fresh air that you're Mekayim the Mitzvah of Hochech Tochiach. And then he explains why he thinks halachically he was allowed to do it. But anyway, because you think it doesn't smell right, I'm no longer going to do it. Can you imagine that guy watching Rav Moshe schlep when he's 90 years old, walking to yeshiva, knowing that that's on his head, that Rav Moshe has to schlep. I once mentioned this in a shir, and someone came over to me after and said, oh, I know the guy. I actually know the guy. He didn't mean it like that at all. He was really just asking questions. Rav Moshe was so humble. He took it as, okay, someone's giving me Moser, and that's it. He changed his hanaga based on that Moser. Not only that, Rav Moshe, when you asked Rav Moshe a shayla, and it was an embarrassing shayla, like you ask, how do I do tshuva for, you know, Hotzah Zer Levatala, for Mishkav Zachar, for like embarrassing shaylas. He wouldn't include the name of the person in the tshuva. In this tshuva, he includes the name of the person. He didn't think the person had anything to be embarrassed about. What do you mean? He was doing a mitzvah, v'chech tochiach. Like, it wouldn't occur to him that there would be anything to be embarrassed about in that tshuva.
Is this regarding taking criticism in every aspect of your Rabbanus, or like even the drasha that you give? Because if you try to please everybody, sometimes you'll just make yourself crazy.
You can please everybody, but you should listen to everybody. Listen, you know, listen to their perspective. And sometimes you'll change it up a little bit, and if someone thinks, you know, you're not giving enough mussar about business people, sometimes they get not enough mussar, too much intellectual stuff, you know, not enough, or you're not in touch with what business people have to go through. That, like, I'm on a business trip all the time, and a guy says to me once, I'm by the elevators at the hotel, and there are mamish prostitutes hanging out there for all the businessmen. You know what kind of taivas businessmen face? I'm like, what? You know, like, I never even heard of this. And, you know, so, like, I mentioned something in a drush, and everyone's like, what? So that was just that one guy that I don't know where he goes. He goes to CD motels or something for his business trips, or in Vegas or whatever. But, you know, you have to, but you should listen to people. You should listen to people. I had a great advantage early on that... I had living a block and a half away from me and davening in my shul, because it was a closed shul and it was difficult for him to walk, Rabbi Maurice Lamb. Rabbi Maurice Lamb, Zichrono Levracha, was the brother of Rabbi Norman Lamb, but leaving aside any brother relationship, he alone was an extraordinarily accomplished pulpit rabbi. He wrote probably, I would imagine, the best-selling Jewish book of halacha in the 20th century, for sure. Maybe Mishnah Brura, I don't know, but he wrote the certainly in English, he wrote a book called The Jewish Way in Death and Mourning that sold over 1 million copies. You know, like, I write a book of my shiurim and I print 800, you know, hoping for the best, you know. He sold over a million copies of the book, like that. And he was the rabbi of the largest shul in the West Coast at some point. Where Rabbi Kalman Top is now, your neck of the woods, no?
Under the valley.
Oh yeah, so yeah, this yeah, is yeah. But I'm sure you've heard of Beth Jacob, right?
Yeah.
So he was the rabbi there for a number of years. Anyway, so I asked Rabbi Lamb to critique my drasha once. So he said to me, "Are you sure?" I said, "Yeah, yeah." He sat with me for an hour and a half one Shabbos afternoon, and like went at me, and it was fantastic. Now it's different when it's a rabbi doing it, because you can really be mekabel, especially with someone who's much older and is much more experienced. But you should be mekabel from everybody to a certain extent. Some of the best etzas I got were from balabatim who speak and who are, you know, and who notice things. You know, one fellow came over to me and said to a friend of mine, one of my good friends came over to me and said, you have a tendency when to use the same word over and over again. Just change it up. Get a thesaurus. You know, just change up the word. There are many ways to say the same thing, and it makes it less boring when you do that. Great etza. That was a fantastic etza. Someone else said, you keep stapling the pages of your drasha. I always write out every drasha. Says, you keep stapling the pages. It's distracting to see the flipping of the pages. Don't staple them. Just slide them on the shtender, and it's less distracting. Great etza. So I got that etza 15 years ago when I was an assistant rabbi in Shari Tfila by someone, one of the members of the shul. Fantastic etza. So be receptive. Be receptive. Sometimes the etzas will be good. Sometimes they won't be so good, but be receptive. Be open.
Did you like ask these people for advice? Or did they just...
No, they volunteered. Rabbi Lam, I asked for advice, but the rest of the...
Do you think it's proper, you know, as Balabatim, they should just be, you know, criticizing, you know, like, oh, I didn't like this drasha, I didn't like...
Whether it's proper or not, you don't control that. You don't get to control what they do.
No, you could foster, you could say, oh, you know, thank you, tell me again, or you could say, like, just, you know, accept it and...
Rabbi Palm's grandson, Binyamin Palm, Davin Zemeshul, that's why I have a sheikh with his father, with Rabbi Aaron Palm. And Binyamin Palm, if you ever read the Rav Palm biography, Binyamin Palm was the source of much of the information, because he spent a great deal of time with his grandfather, mostly because he was the black sheep of his family. I don't think he minds me saying this. He was every other member of his family was like Lakewood Mir, you know, or Mir Lakewood, you know. It ended up in one of those places. It was mamish, like right in line with what Dr. Pelkovitz calls the family bumper sticker. He was not. He spent time in the Far East. He did a lot of weird things, like, you know, so he was very much not. So Palm really took him under his wing and would sit and learn with him every day, which was, they had officially like a Seder and a Chavetz Chaim, but he said it was mostly schmoozing. And, you know, and his grandfather is the reason he's from today. So he had like a lot of sheikhs with his grandfather. So he tells me a lot of nice things about it. So one of the things he said was that he was with his grandfather once. His grandfather spoke at a Torah Masorah convention or something, and someone came over to him and said, Palm, you spoke beautifully. And he said, thank you so much. I never know how I did. no one ever tells me if I did bad or did well. It's just, it's nice to hear when I did well. And a lot of times you could tell, because you could tell by the way that people come up to you. You know, there are certain people that every Shabbos, Yashakoyach, great job, you know, okay. So it's nice. It's really nice. It's very sweet of them to say that every Shabbos. But you also know that, like they say it every Shabbos, then there are some people that will come once in a while. That one was a good one. So, you know, okay, so that was taka, you know, something you want to use again. So that's what people are. That's what people will do. Usually it's nice to hear nice things. Certainly you should realize that it's nice for other people to hear nice things. Anyone else says a Dvar Torah in your shul, not just thank you for the Dvar Torah. The idea you said about da-da-da really resonated with me, you know, or something like that. Like, be specific in your compliments. Make it sound like you actually listened, you know. So, and you should actually listen, but be specific as you can. And an encouraging word from you, and that's, I guess, leads me into the next part, the power to build. Small things, small thinking of you, texts for someone who's going through a hard time, a good Shabbos phone call. I remember attending Rabbi J.J. Schachter's Shabbos HaGadol Drasha when he was rabbi in the Jewish Center, and his daughter pointed out to us afterwards how full the Ezra's Nashim was with old almanos, and they didn't understand a word of, most of them didn't understand a word of it. He was giving a lamda shashir or whatever. There's no way they understood most of what he was talking about for the first 45 minutes of his drasha. Why did they come? Because, you know, he would joke, those are my girlfriends, you know, that those are the people he calls every Erev Shabbos. You know, they're 80-year-old almanas who get a phone call from him every single week to say good Shabbos, and that means something. I have a very close friend who I admire a great deal, Rabbi Shmuel Marcus, who took over the a shul in Kiron Hills recently, and also people told me that, like, the old women have come to the shul because he's there for them, you know. He's there for them constantly. You know, always calling to say good Shabbos in the hospital when they're in the hospital. Always there for them. You could build people that way, and they'll be appreciative. I just had we don't do enough, probably, I don't do enough in terms of that, you know, in terms of the people, just being there for people as much as I should. And probably no one do I fall short in terms of the cover that they deserve than Mrs. Lamb. Mrs. Lamb is an almana, lives a block and a half away from me. I should be by her house every single Shabbos. I should be by, you know, just making sure. My wife and I were taking a walk last Motzei Shabbos, and we saw, thank God, she has a beautiful family, so her grandchildren are always coming over Motzei Shabbos. So we saw that there was action in the house Motzei Shabbos, and my wife and I said, we'll stop and say hello. The grandchildren pull us aside afterwards, and they say, we can't thank you enough. All she talks about is how kind you are and what you do this for her and what you invite her and this and that. And we're like embarrassed. Like, we don't do nearly enough for her. But the little bit that we do means so much. It means so much to a person. Like, what? For a phone call on an Erev Shabbos, inviting for a Shabbos meal where you know, she doesn't eat that much, doesn't really take that much. For what? But it means so much to somebody when you, that's the power to build is a very critical power. You should also realize that if you are a shul rabbi, certainly your primary job is not to run the shul per se. There are many rabbis that do believe that your primary job is to run the shul. I do not believe that's your job. It's part of your job to help run the shul together with a good team of gabayim and lay leadership and board, the board and the president, whoever. Your primary job, and never lose sight of this, your primary job is to inspire to greater avodas Hashem, period, full stop. Inspire to greater avodas Hashem. That's done through teaching Torah in an inspiring way, inspiring others not just to learn Torah and to come to your shiurim, but to give shiurim of their own, to share Torah, to write Torah, to get a chavrusa, creative programming, promoting inspired tefillah, inspired families. Your primary job is that people who come to your shul should feel like that they are greater Ovdei Hashem because they are part of that community that is your community or your shul that you are a part of. Everybody should be able to think that they're more connected to the Ribbono Shel Olam or realize that they're more connected to the Ribbono Shel Olam because of that involvement. Yeah.
So Ephraim Goldberg, when he came to speak to us, he said that he sees the role of a rabbi as almost like a CEO or like something like that. You said that's a different halach.
I would never say that anything that Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg says is
no, it's different.
He does an unbelievable job. Now, what he means by CEO is that I think, if I could be so bold as to, I've been in a shul many times, and we go way, way back. We were in shir together, Baruch Shechter. And what he means by CEO is that a CEO knows that he can't do everything himself. And that he has to have someone who's in charge of this, someone who's in charge of that, and he is the master. Rabbi Goldberg is the master of delegating responsibilities to capable people and trusting them.
Right.
There are certain rabbis that are such micromanagers; they trust nobody. An effective CEO does not do that. You have to trust that it's not against what I'm saying. It's exactly what I'm saying. That you, and that gives you the ability to inspire people in your... There's a difference between what you do on a day-to-day basis and what your goal is. Your goal is more inspired Jews, period. I think that's Rabbi Goldberg's goal also.
I think he was saying, like, this is the way he uses his drasha on young Ryan, is to really, like, he's like the captain steering ship. It's like, he's like giving the vision for the shore. This is what we're going to focus on
right.
This year.
Right, exactly. What you're going to focus on this year. But all of that is why do people need focus? Because they need to know how to be better of the Hashem this year. So if you focus that goal, if you focus that, then when you talk about something and you give a goal, people will automatically, there's studies done on this in Harvard, people automatically will get better at it. Just by talking about something, even if you're talking about it in the worst possible way and you're not even effectively, but just by making it a topic of conversation. And that's what he does extremely effectively, that he makes a goal each year, that he sets a vision for each. This year, it's going to be about the chesed of our community. This year, it's going to be about the achdus of our community. This year, it's going to be about Talmud Torah. This year, it's going to be about, and that enables people to grow. The most important thing is that people very often, when I've spoken to Rabbanim who've told me that they love dealing with teenagers because teenagers know that they're not complete yet and that they need to develop and that they need to grow. Adults very often feel like I am what I am. To convince an adult, and when Moshe Weinberger spoke in my shul a few months ago, the way I introduced him was that I think he appreciated it was that his greatest accomplishment is not, I hope he didn't mind that I said this, is not in spreading chassidus to the modern Orthodox community. That's a hechitimtza. His greatest accomplishment was convincing adults that they can still grow. And essentially raising, not being an inspiration to an entire generation of younger rabbis who now bought into that and believe that we can inspire adults to believe that they can still grow. And there's no one that does a better job of that than Rabbi Goldberg. He's a rock star. I mean, he's the best. And partially because he's so humble and he'll never call himself a rock star. But to be able to inspire people to grow wherever they are in life and wherever they are religiously and whatever their background is, to grow. That's all God wants from us. What should I be doing today? Something a little bit more than what I did yesterday. That's it. That's the answer. And that will help people define themselves by their connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which would mean they always have that solid basis in their lives of no matter what happens to them professionally or in any other areas of their lives, they're not going to feel like a failure because they're growing in their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's how they define themselves and that's how they define success, so that ultimately they're successful. And then one final section that I wanted to get to. You know, there's a story that always resonated with me. Well, I'm not exactly sure how the story played out, where there was some arguments about a kibbut at a chuppah. Someone came last minute. Do I cut this Rosh Yeshiva out of getting this bracha, that bracha? And Rosh Hashanah Norbach apparently was there. Rosh Hashanah says, how could anyone be makbid on a kavod to say shahakol bara lichvodo? There's only one kavod. There's only one power. There's only one honor, and that's shahakol bara lichvodo. Don't be makbid on your own kavod. Every time a person says, it's not my kavod, it's the kavod at Torah, that's like when a person says, with all due respect, you know, like, you know, when they say with all due respect, they don't believe any respect is due. You know when a person says, to be totally honest with you, that they're not being totally honest with you. And you know when a person says, it's not my kavod, it's the kavod at Torah, that it's all about their kavod and it's not about the kavod at Torah. Don't be so makbid on your kavod. If you think it's the kavod at Torah, really, really think twice about whether it's the kavod at Torah. You know, Chazal tells us that Dveikus B'Hashem, as we mentioned before, is through connection to Talmid Chabim. You might be the Rashka Bahag of wherever you are, of Ashkash, where, in a shul full of people who were never zocha to the kind of Jewish education that you may have received, and they think that you're a genius because you could read Rashi and Chumash and that you're the greatest rabbi, and you could start believing them. That, wow, I really am. I'm an Adam Chashuv. I'm an Adam Gadol. Stay connected to your Rashi Yeshiva. Stay connected to, listen to their shiurim. Stay connected to them. Spend time with them whenever you can, just so that you can realize how small you are. You know, every time you start thinking about yourself as big, spend some time with Rav Shachter. Spend some time with Rav Gulick. Spend some time with Rav Tversky. And, feel small again. Not to say the other Rashi, all the Rashi Yeshiva. Spend some time with great people, so you can realize how small you are. Because otherwise, it's easy to forget. For me, I find it effective to just open up an Eretz HaTzvi. Like, it's so humbling, because no one even talks about Rav Shachter's lamdas. They don't even think like he's a lamdan. You know, his bekiyus, his koach hapsak, his lamdas is overwhelming. But people don't even talk about that. You know, it's like, just remember what a gadol looks like. To connect to the Shechina, it's very critical. Chazal tells him, Sachs Ksuvus Ishvi Isha Shalom Beinehem Shechina Shriya Beinehem. So if you're going to be that connection to the Shechina, you need a profound sense of Shechina in your life. And in order to get that profound sense of Shechina in your life, it's very important to have an Isha who's on board and who's going to allow for the presence of Shechina in your home. And you have to do whatever you can to protect, honor, and revere your wife. She is sometimes, for many rabbis, the only person that calls the rabbi by his first name, the only person that will sort of cut them down to size. You listen to the way Rebbe Shechter talks to Rav Shechter. That's bekavana. That's not an accident. It's the way he wants it. It's the way he needs it to be. And you know that classic line that was retweeted 1,000 times when the point in NCSY caller asked her, "What's it like to be married to the Gadol Hadar?" And she said, "Don't know. You got to ask my husband." that's okay. That's good. You need someone to sort of cut you down to size, and that you could be there for, and you could deflect all of that kavod to her, and that she'll know, who you really are. And what you really deserve and what you don't deserve. And one final element of Shakol Barah L'Chvado, that everything is for the one and only honor, is that it's very important to make your tefillah count. Orthodox Jews in general have a tendency to stop growing in tefillah at a very, very early age. Torah, we continue to grow through yeshiva years. Very often, fifth, sixth grade, like once we know how to read all the words, people stop growing in tefillah, and that's really tragic. Your whole life, you have to be growing in tefillah, especially when you're davening for your dear friends in your shul, and when you're davening for family, and when people share with you all their tzaros, it means you have a greater responsibility of tefillah. So you have to be davening for a lot more people, not because you're so special, but because people share with you by virtue of your position everything that they're going through, and they need tefillos. And they need to know how to daven, and they need to look at you for tefillah. And very often, it's a very comforting thing for people to hear that you are davening for them, and that and that it's sincere, that it's real. That you know the names of the members of the family that are cholim, because you know those names, because those are the names that are on your mind, that are on your mind constantly. So just to quickly review what we've done, the power of being a rabbi. First of all, never view it as a power per se. Always be humble. Humility is so critical for everybody. For a rabbi, it's twice as critical. Yet, there is power in the sense that you have the power to destroy lives by saying the wrong thing, not treating people properly, not behaving properly, and remember that power to destroy. And there's also tremendous power to build by saying the right thing, by doing the little things, by inspiring people toward greater avodas Hashem. But ultimately, we always have to remember that there is a one and only power. The one and only power is the Ribono Shel Olam. And as Mori V'Rabbi Rabbi Kamenetsky always used to tell us in the Rebbeim and DRS, whenever a difficult decision came up, or whenever it was an issue of recruiting, is that yeshiva going to outdo us? We work for the Ribono Shel Olam. That's it. We work for the Ribono Shel Olam. And that's the attitude that one has to take when you're in this line of business. You work for the Ribono Shel Olam. So it's not about, how can I compete with that shul and do better? You're working for the Ribono Shel Olam. It's how can I inspire the people that are here? And if the Ribono Shel Olam wants more people to come my way because he thinks that they'll be more inspired, so Mirtzah Hashem, that will happen as well. But I work for the Ribono Shel Olam. And that always has to be the attitude. Shakol Barah L'Chvado.
If you're the rov of one of the communities, five towns or something like that, do you have a responsibility?
No one's the rov of the five towns.
Yeah,
I'm
the five towns. Yeah.
Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, Zichron Levrachet, once told me that when he left Toronto, he was a rov in Toronto, and then he came to Lawrence. He said, when I left Toronto, and he was a rov in Lawrence for like 3 decades, I think at least, and he said, when I left Toronto, I left Rabbanus. He said, I used to be the rov of a community, in Lawrence I'm the rov of a block.
Okay, so my wife's from Flatbush.
Yeah.
So in Flatbush, Rabbi Leaf, Rabbi Moshe Tuvi Leaf, looks out for all the other rabbanim of the shuls. Do you have a responsibility if you're to kind of?
That's something that usually happens organically,
uh-huh.
In Riverdale. All the other rabbanim go to Rabbi Willig for their shailas and to discuss not all the communal issues, but to discuss a number of things, because he's Rabbi Willig, and that's something that more happens organically. It is very, very important to have a good relationship with other rabbanim. You're going to get up and you're going to preach about achdus and about love, but if you view the other rabbanim in the community as your competition, and I am very, very fortunate that I live in North Woodmere, where The two other rabbis that have been there for a while now are Rabbi Yehuda Septimus, who's Rabbi of Young Israel of North Woodmere, and Rabbi Shmuel Witkin, who's Rabbi of Kehilas B'nai HaYeshivas. So, you know, it's the kind of shul that you would imagine is called Kehilas B'nai HaYeshivas, more of a flappish type of shul. And Young Israel of North Woodmere is, I don't know, that my shul is Beis HaKnesses of North Woodmere, I guess, you know, somewhere in the middle or whatever. And both of them are such Anshei Shalom that all they want to do is make sure that they're shalom, that that we get, and that's a huge advantage. You know, when we have a hakafa together in the streets on Simchas Torah night, when you know the kavod that they give each other and that we give each other, when we come into each other's shuls, it's a tremendous advantage. And I can't tell you how many balabatim, community members, when they see Rabbi Septimus greet me in the street with a giant hug. He greets everyone that way, but still, when he greets me with a big hug in the street, how many community members say it's so inspiring to see the rabbis get along like that? And it's very important. Yeah.
I know it's a big topic. We definitely hate to about, let's say when either shuls come to the community and form a shul by taking members from the existing shul, or breakaways, maintaining positive relationships.
It's a difficult topic because it's a very difficult topic, because maintaining positive relationships with the people who broke away.
Let's say those rabbis. I'm assuming the goal is to maintain a positive relationship with those rabbis.
Yeah. Usually it's, I could tell you this is happening where I live. In North Woodmere, I was not the first show in town. Young Israel of North Woodmere was there before us. Then our Torah a little further down, Young Israel of North Woodmere is modern Orthodox shul. The people in my shul wanted a little more of right wing YU kind of place, and they asked me to come and start the shul, and we did. And then Rabbi Witkin came and started a more flappish yeshivish background type of place, and I felt at that time, although when I started, I'm sure the Young Israel of North Woodmere was not so happy, and when Rabbi Witkin started, there are many members of my shul. I gave a Shabbos a Gadol Drasha. Get over yourselves. It's okay for other people to have a different flavor of Judaism, to have a different style, and why can't they daven here? But get over. And what if they raise the standard of what your expectations are from Kai and Sneus or whatever? Is that going to be so terrible? So get over yourselves. So at that point, I felt personally, this is ideal, that here we have, a more yeshivish place, a more modern. There are very few places that could work like Boca Raton Synagogue, where there's only zoning for one shul to exist in the entire circle. So they have to be everything to everybody, and therefore you could have six shuls in one shul. Very few places will operate that way. Halavai if everyone could, but it's not practical in most communities. So I thought we were in a very, very good spot. Since then, because everyone was defined, it was very clearly defined, and we all got along. So that was great. Everyone's defined, and we get along. Since then, three other shuls have opened up. Why? Why are you needed? Why does this have to be? Don't you think? So it's very easy to feel insulted. What am I not providing? What's wrong? Or to take it out on the rabbis that who just need, they want a job. They want to be a rabbi the same way you want to be a rabbi. The Ribbono Shel Olam runs the world. You work for the Ribbono Shel Olam. So whether you think it's the right thing, the wrong thing, you have no control over it. So to take a firm stance and whatever, it's not going to help anything. Either it's just going to cause division in the community. So that's not going to work. It's not going to help. So you show love to the rabbis, you show love to the other people, and it is unfortunate, and I think people should be given most of that. They should belong somewhere, because you should know this it is very important, and I don't know how to solve this problem. When you have oversaturation, like in Flatbush or like in the Five Towns, an oversaturation of shuls. I was just talking to a friend of mine last week about this. I was walking by. I walked to Shalom Zachar last Friday night in Woodsburg. So on the way back, I was walking through Woodmere and through, it was a 3-mile walk, so I got to see a lot of people along the way. And I was walking with a friend of mine, Rabbi Eli Storch, and the first question he would ask everybody was, "Oh, where are you davening tomorrow?" "Oh, I haven't decided yet, this, that." That is terrible. If a person doesn't know where he's going to be davening the next morning, that means that he's not really part of anything. And, some people will sell it as, "I'm a community person." I'm a community person. No, you're not. A community person is someone who belongs to something and therefore can contribute and build the community through that. There's a guy, I'll tell you his name just so you know that I'm not making stuff up. I'm not going to pick someone from my shul. There are plenty of people that in my shul like this also. There's a guy in the Young Israel of North Woodmere in Rabbi Septimus' shul, who I know from high school already. His name is Jordan Hiller. Wonderful, wonderful guy. He became president of that shul. He built that shul in terms of its membership, its ruchnius, its spirit, its everything. He is Mr. Community. He's all about the community because he's working from a position of strength. He's actually helped build up a communal institution. That helps community. When you're a guy who jumps here, there, so no one knows who you are, and you'll have five people at your simcha, five rabbis at your simchas who will say trite pleasantries if they're asked to speak, but don't really know you. And by the way, you're hesped also. If you really become someone who belongs to something and you help build up an institution, so that's how you become a community person. But as far as a rabbi dealing with a multiplicity of shuls, so that's an unfortunate outgrowth of the fact that there are so many shuls. It is an unfortunate thing, and people need to be taught that you should belong to something and you should help build something. But to walk around with a chip on your shoulder, it's just not healthy. You know, you can have your opinion, but it's not healthy for the community. It doesn't set a proper example.
Let's say, sometimes you see this in a small community, like the out-of-town community, where there's barely enough people.
There are 12 Jews and two shuls.
Right? So you're saying even then it's not worth taking a stance.
You have to get Eitzah from an outsider or something like that. I mean, if it's really going to kill the whole place, I don't know. I was never in that position, you know. Where I am, you know, so the shul has a dream of building up to 300 families, and now we're going to be stuck at 100 because every time another 10 families move in, they start another shul. You know, okay, so the Ribbono Shel Olam wants you to be, you know, wants you to daven together with 100 people. So that's what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants from you. Oh, but then what's going to be building this? That this is what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants from you, and that you have to deal. It's not an excuse to cause a breakdown in the shalom.
I'm curious, let's say, if you meet people you don't know, do you usually introduce yourself with the title rabbi? You know, I'm Rabbi so-and-so, or just, you know, that's my first name? Because, you know, that plays a large part in, you know, like, feeling a power, like, oh, you know, I'm a rabbi. Like,
my rabbeim never introduced themselves by rabbi. You know, when Rav Schechter calls, hey, it's Herschel Schechter. I know who it is. You know, my rabbeim never did that.
So some people don't know. They're like, oh, you're just another guy. You know, you're
the only time my rabbi ever did that, Rabbi Willig told me that when he found a wallet on a train or something, so it was a non-Jewish person who lost their wallet, so he wanted to make Kiddush Hashem. So when he sent a note back to the person, when he shipped it back to them, Rabbi Mordechai Willig. Okay, good. That's a good thing to do. But there's no... I think it's a little off-putting. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not judging anybody. Sometimes people have a cheshbon and why they do that. But you know, if I need a secretary to take me seriously, you know, I need to speak to the lawyer, and I call his office, and the secretary answers. I'll tell him it's Rabbi Leibowitz. Also, because she won't be able. Aryeh, what's Aryeh? You know, she can't pronounce the name.
like, let's say you're a rabbi, like I'm teaching in school this year, so you know, like you're.
What do you teach?
Fourth grade.
Where?
MDS.
MDS. Okay, very
MDS,
nice.
So there's a question, like, how do I introduce myself to the parents? You know.
To the students, you rabbi. To the kids, you have to be rabbi. Parents, I don't think you have to be. When I started teaching, I was 22 years old. Rabbi Kamenetsky, I don't know, must have not been feeling well or something that day. He offered me a job, I remember, like 2-3 years after I started teaching, I got a phone call from a parent of one of the boys in one of my classes, and the parent said, I just wanted to know, you know, I have a girl for a shidduch, you know, this and that. I'm like, oh, it sounds wonderful. Let me just ask my wife and three kids. Like, he couldn't imagine that I was. Maybe he didn't have a beard. I don't know. He thought, what kind of bent Torah doesn't grow a beard after he gets married?
Wow.
But it's okay to carry yourself in a way that, you know, look at the way Rabbi Savlovsky carries himself. You know, like, have you ever seen anything like that? The man is mishichma lamaila above every. Do you realize it? I don't know if people maybe don't realize this, right? You realize he's a Kohen Olam. He's like mishichma lamaila above anyone in pretty much, I don't know, the United States, the world, his age, you know? And he walks around here like he's one of the young Rebbeim, you know? It's okay to be like that. It's okay to be like that. Makam gadusa shematam osen vasnusa. It's easy for the rest of us to walk around like that, but it's inspiring. But you should always remember that inspiration, because a lot of times, like I said, you're out in the middle somewhere, and people are just telling you how great you are, and you start to believe them. And remember what greatness looks like.
And that's like you're in a place where they have no idea who you are. Like, let's say, like, you're new to a shul, you're like walking around in a kiddush, and like, really, there are a lot of people who might not know who you are. So, like, you say your first name.
Yeah,
it's like,
use
okay.
Your judgment. Use your judgment. Hi, my name is Aryeh Leibowitz. I'm the new rabbi here. I just don't think, like, you know, it's Rabbi Leibowitz to you. You know,
they may start calling you by your first name. Like,
yeah, if they're that.
Because they, you know.
Right.
Tell you
yeah, right. Some of these shuls where they just take out a guitar and call you Rabbi Johnny or something. I don't know.
Yeah,
every shul has a different culture. I don't know. I'm just not used to that. I'm in the Five Towns. I don't really know what's out there so much. Yeah, you have to speak to people who know a lot more than me about that. I'm sure the people in the placement office could tell you about the culture in different places. I really don't know. When I go visit people, I go visit my sister in Florida or California because the weather's nice. not so often in the smaller places. Although in the summers, I take the children on a road trip usually to ball games. So wherever there's, you know, we've stopped in like every little town in Ohio or, you know. So yeah, we've been to a lot of places. We thought Columbus would be a small place. It's massive. So that wasn't small, but there are a lot of smaller places in Ohio also, and other states. That was nice to see that also. Yeah. Okay. I wish you all tremendous, tremendous hatzlacha. I thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And
thank you,
you should all make a great Kiddush Hashem for the rest of your life.